I guess I'm the token entomologist here. That for me, it's actually, I'm always amazed how, you know, plant and insect people don't talk together, even though we've, in this case, all study biological invasions. And I think there are amazing numbers of similarities. And so I know I learn a lot from hearing stuff about plant invasions and probably should listen more to this kind of stuff. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about kind of a general overview. And some of the stuff I'm going to be, some of this is just going to be kind of general stuff about forest insect disease invasions. In fact, I realized in my title I didn't actually have the word forest insects and diseases, which I'm really just talking about forest insects and diseases. Some of the stuff I'm going to be talking about is some work that I've been doing as part of a project that the Nature Conservancy started, and they were in working with the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis, NCES, University of California in Santa Barbara, brought together a group of ecologists and economists to try to quantify the impacts of forest insects and diseases. And so that's some of the numbers that we've brought together are coming from that. And if I had time, I would acknowledge all the multitude of people been working on this. I always think with invasions in general, it's always good. And, you know, I think Dick in his talk was mentioning the same sort of three categories of focusing, differentiating the arrival, establishment, and spread process. Of course, arrivals getting there, establishment is growing to the point where populations can't go extinct, and then spread being the expansion of the species into its potential range. And one of the things that I think useful about recognizing is I'm going to be talking a little bit about also is management of invasions of forest insects and diseases. And I think it's important to recognize that for each of these stages, we have these quarantines and inspections for preventing arrival, detection and eradication for preventing establishment, and then barrier zones and domestic quarantines for preventing spread. And I'm going to kind of march through these categories using some forest insect and disease examples to explore those. And so certainly with forest insects and diseases, the problem really can be traced to the trends in world trade and travel. And so this is something that I think the biological invasion problem in general is related to this, but certainly for forest insects and diseases, this is the situation. So one of the main invasion pathways for forest insect diseases are hitchhiking. That is just where life stages get attached to objects that get shipped around the world, and we know things like shipping containers are really fantastic things for this because they go from one place in the world to very remote places in other continents. One of the pathways that more recently we were realizing is really potentially a bad pathway for forest insects and diseases are plants. And specifically, there's this whole category maybe you folks are familiar with, that we refer to as plants for planting, that there's this trend going on really in the last 5 years when you go to Home Depot or Lowe's and you buy an apple tree, there's a chance that that tree came from China. And why this is legal, I think, is just incredible. But it's going on, and until some sort of regulations close that pathway, it's going to continue to go on. And we know that it's for forest insects and diseases, a serious one. The other one, which is finally one of the most serious invasion pathways, is the movement of raw wood. And this is very often wood that's shipped as packing material. Very often, people, when they're packing materials for crating or dunnage or spooling, they use the very lowest quality wood, very often the wood that has bark associated with it. And this is very often the parts of wood that are quite likely to harbor insects and diseases. And so this is, as I'll mention a little bit, has turned out to be really important. So these are some of the, in this effort to quantify the impacts of exotic forest insects and diseases, we've looked at, compiled lists of both essentially all insects, non-native insect species. We have some 400 species of non-native forest insects in the U.S. And then we also subset those to recognize that some of a small fraction, maybe about 20% of those, are actually species that we know have some sort of effect on in forests at all. When we look at this over time, basically somewhere around 1860, things sort of changed, and would appear that we've had this increase, its accumulation has been increasing somewhat linearly over time, about 2.5 species per year of all of the forest insects get established every year. For the economically significant ones, we're getting about 0.5 species per year. And that graph I showed you may be a little bit misleading because it suggests that it's really a constant thing. But it turns out if you look at all insects, there was sort of a pulse around the early 1900s and then some of a decline. This may have had to do with the implementation of some of the domestic quarantine act and some of the efforts that were made to quarantine material that's entering the U.S. But the other thing that you see is in these patterns is in the last two decades, there's been, these are basically numbers of species arriving or establishing every decade by different groups, I should mention. And so the same pattern you can see in the sap feeders and foliage feeders. But in the economically significant species, you see in the last two decades, we've seen a remarkably large number of economically significant species becoming established. The other trend that you see, and this is probably maybe explaining this pattern, is we've had a big increase in the number of wood borers. And again, these wood borers, the main mechanism by which they enter is this solid wood packing material. So I think a lot of this can be traced back to solid wood packing material. And in fact, if you look at some of this, sort of zoom into some of these patterns, we look at the bark beetles. What we used to be a family. It was the scolitids. It's now recognized as a subfamily of the weevils, the scolitini. And you look at numbers of species established over a year. European species, which used to be most of the invasions were from European species, they've increased, but not almost leveled out. Whereas you look at species establishing from Asia has in more recent decades just taken off. And again, I think this is reflecting trade, increasing trade with Asian trade partners, and the use of solid wood packing material in shipping that material, because that's how these things get in. One really interesting thing we did, and I'm not going to go into too much detail, but we basically mapped the distribution, took all of these 70-some species of forest insects and diseases that have quantifiable effects on forests, and we in a GIS, compiled county-level records of their distributions. And then overlaid essentially the number of species in the United States. And you can see it's not a very uniform distribution. And so it obviously shows that for those of us who live in the northeastern U.S., this is where the invasion problem is greatest. And of course, it's one of these things where you can actually, there are a lot of reasons you can bring up to explain this. I mean, part of it is there's a much longer history of human civilizations or European civilization in the eastern United States, and certainly one of trade. But actually, it turns out when we've actually done statistical analyses of these data, what actually does the best job of explaining this relationship is not historical trade, or it's not historical population levels, but it's actually the diversity of host trees at the generic level. So in other words, this is also, the eastern U.S. is also the area with the largest species richness of trees. And these are just tree feeding species that I'm showing here. And I think basically what it comes down to is in the east, because there's a much larger species richness in the eastern U.S., that's what, it's sort of like a bigger target. Most of these insects and diseases are specific at the genus level. And so basically, by having more genera of trees in the eastern U.S., this makes for more likely invasion. Anyway, it's an interesting thing. So let's see. I think I've been talking about arrival. Let me just say a few things about establishment. And really, I was going to, as I mentioned before, and Dick was mentioning this earlier about eradication as our main tool for preventing establishment. We probably don't use it enough. I didn't even realize I had this in here, the little animations, but, so one, talking about eradication, I just wanted to bring up the gypsy moth, which is, most of my research has been on the gypsy moth, and it's native to most of temperate Eurasia, and in 1860 was accidentally brought to the U.S. by this French naturalist who lived here in his house outside of Boston, and they accidentally got loose. And about 15 years later, the government tried to eradicate the population in the Boston area. Ultimately, it failed, and the species has been gradually expanding its range since then. Now, it turns out that we've gotten much better at eradicating gypsy moth populations. Every year, this insect has a terrible habit of getting associated as a hitchhiker with things like recreational vehicles and other things that are accidentally transported to the western United States. And every year, over 100,000 pheromone traps, or very sensitive devices for detecting populations, are put out in these western states. And every year we have anywhere between 3 to 10 projects where these incipient populations are eradicated. And the eradication, let's see if I have, oh, I don't have a slide for it, but most of the eradications are carried out using aerial applications of Bacillus thuringiensis. So we've gotten much better at eradicating gypsy moth. And in fact, I would say the gypsy moth is a relatively easy insect to eradicate. And why that is, I could go into a lot of explanations of. One main one is we have a very powerful tool for detecting low-level populations using these pheromone traps. In New Zealand, I always think, if you really want to see where we should be in terms of managing invasions, we really should look at New Zealand, because in many of those of you who are familiar with New Zealand know that biological invasions have a very high profile in that country, and they're much more serious about it. Consequently, they're much more serious about eradicating forest insect populations. They've had, over the last decade, 5 species of exotic forest insects show up as reproducing populations, and they succeeded in eradicating 4 of those 5. Some of those using what we would probably consider rather austere methods, but this is the case of the painted apple moth in the city of Auckland. They ended up aerially spraying some neighborhoods over 20 times over a 2-year period with Bacillus thuringiensis, but they succeeded in eradicating it. And as Dick pointed out, you save centuries of suffering as a result of that. The other thing you can say about New Zealand is they have much more stringent about border inspections, and really take a look at every container that comes in the country. All baggage is screened for. And they're not looking for bombs; they're looking for smuggled fruit and this sort of thing. So the last thing I was going to talk about a little bit was spread, and again about managing spread, and again using the gypsy moth. I think is we've been studying the gypsy moth for over 100 years in this country, and we know a lot about it. And with the current range of the gypsy moth, again, Boston was where it was introduced. This map shows essentially the distribution of susceptible forest types where we can expect it to be defoliated. And you can see, even in the eastern U.S., the gypsy moth hasn't really gotten to some of the best places. And so because of this, a program was put in place in 1999 as a national program of basically a barrier zone. It's basically a 100-kilometer band all along the expanding front of the expanding gypsy moth population front. And this program is based on sort of the biological reality of what we know about gypsy moth spread. We know a lot about the spread of this organism. And like a lot of species, it doesn't just continuously expand, but we know that it spreads via populations being accidentally moved out in front of the infested front, and these founding populations form isolated colonies and grow and eventually coalesce. And so basically the focus of this project is not, we know we can't stop the spread of the gypsy moth, but the idea is to use a grid of pheromone traps to find these isolated populations and essentially nuke them before they start to grow and coalesce. And so most of the effort goes into finding these isolated populations, which is done using, as I mentioned before, a 2-kilometer grid of pheromone traps, these things. This is just a map from the state of Wisconsin. I don't know if you can make that out, but each of these dots is one pheromone trap. And these data go into us using GPSs. They're used by the field crews, goes into a central GIS, which then is used to make decisions about areas where to treat. So essentially, there's a baseline grid of 2-kilometer grid traps. If the trap data indicates an isolated population, the next year traps are put in at a higher density 1 kilometer to delimit the population, and then if it's still there in the third year, it's treated. And most of the treatments are done via aerial applications of mating disruption. Originally, when the program started, it was mostly done with bacterial pesticides, but now most of the treatments are done using aerial applications it's a microencapsulated material. It's a plastic laminate in which the pheromone is embedded and slowly releases the material, and it's sprayed out of these aircraft and prevents, at very low densities, it turns out to be very effective at preventing mating and causes these isolated populations to go extinct and thereby slow the spread of the insect. There was a pilot area in the West Virginia, Virginia, where the program was initiated. Prior to the initiation of the program, the average rate of spread was around 21 kilometers per year. And since the program has been in effect, spread rates fluctuate, but they fluctuate at somewhere less than half of what it was before. So it seems to be successful, at an expense of about $10 million a year, by the way. In the last little bit of time I have, I was just going to talk about a little bit about what we know about the impacts of some of these species. As I mentioned before, most species we know, most of the non-indigenous species of forest insects are somewhat inconsequential. That is, you would never notice them. But we do have some of these as we've had more and more species accumulate, certainly there have been some bad players that have come in. One of these, in terms of forest insects and diseases, which there always has a lot of notoriety and certainly had catastrophic effects, was a chestnut blight, which was apparently brought in nursery stock somewhere around the turn of the century and very rapidly expanded its range through eastern North America and caused the virtual elimination of American chestnut, which previously had been a fairly dominant tree species. And so this is an example, and this is not to say that this is representative of most forest insect diseases. And in fact, it's not. This is sort of the extreme case of a catastrophic species. Most of them are inconsequential, but certainly we have these. Unfortunately, because this happened quite a while ago, we don't really know the full consequences of chestnut blight's establishment. Whether there were species of insects that were associated with chestnut that had gone extinct, and the complete consequences of how forests have changed, we don't fully understand. On the other hand, we have something like this that seems to be about this now. Looks like it's going to take place before our eyes again, and that's the invasion by the emerald ash borer, which is a buprestid beetle, and native to Asia, Eastern Asia, and in its native habitat, on the hosts in Asia, it acts very much as a secondary insect, just attacking dead and dying trees. Unfortunately, in North America, it appears that none of the ash species that we have here have any resistance. So instead of this insect just colonizing dead and dying trees, it can colonize and kills living trees. And in fact, it appears in areas where it's been for a while, it looks like it kills essentially all of them, going down to even very small 2-inch diameter saplings. The ash is mostly an eastern species, but there are species in the west and all. And we expect essentially all of this to disappear. The insect was discovered in 2002 outside of Detroit. By the time it was discovered there, it was one of these things that when I drove up there the year after they discovered it, I thought, how could they miss this? Because there just were literally thousands and thousands and thousands of dead trees in the Detroit area. And the reason is, you know, ashes have a lot of diseases and whatnot, so by the time they realized what it was essentially too late to eradicate it. It was over too large of an area. And since then, it's now been discovered in several outlier populations. And we're projecting that it will be a relatively fast, this insect is going to be spread quite quickly over the next 10 years, partly because it has this ability, people accidentally move the insect via movement of infested wood, mostly firewood. And despite all the efforts, you know, we made to make to keep people from stop doing this, they keep moving firewood. One other insect, you know, and I'm not going to run through all of the impacts of all these species, but again, the gypsy moth being a somewhat notorious insect, and in areas, once it becomes established, it goes through these episodes of periodic outbreaks. We know these outbreaks recur statistically on an approximately 5 to 10 year intervals. And so just in the last 2008, this last summer, oh no, 2009, this last summer, I think, well, I'm not sure I've seen the numbers for 2009. 2008, we had about 1 million acres defoliated. It doesn't show up here. So, but the consequences of this is just an aerial shot of the extensive defoliation. The consequences of gypsy moth's defoliation can be extreme. In some cases, it can cause catastrophic levels of mortality, killing large numbers of trees. But in most cases, this is the exception to the rule. In most cases, trees survive a gypsy moth defoliation. And the main impact of the gypsy moth, in contrast to some of these catastrophic things like emerald ash borer or chestnut blight, are just the nuisance that people who live in the area of gypsy moths don't like, having large numbers of dead caterpillars and their excrement on their picnic tables. And as a result of this, there's tremendous pressure put on the government to spray, to prevent outbreaks, which is almost an impossible thing to do, but we do it anyway. And it's very much of a people problem, which doesn't mean that it's not a problem, but it's just the ecological impacts of this insect are not as big as the effects on humans. So I'm going to sort of getting close to finishing what I was going to say, and one last thing I want to sort of touch on in terms of forest insects and diseases is that, you know, I think I mentioned this, we were, you know, analyzing this whole problem, differentiating between this, the vast majority of the non-native insects are these species that we don't really think are having any noticeable effects versus this minority, which we know do have some kind of economic impacts. The only thing is that we're this difference, these species that we think are inconsequential, probably not all of them are inconsequential. And a lot of them are maybe situations where we just don't know. And a really good example of this are ambrosia beetles. I don't know if any of you know about ambrosia beetles. These are insects that are also in this subfamily Scolotini, and they're insects that colonize dead wood, and they have these symbiotic fungi, and they inoculate the tree with the fungi, and then they feed on the fungi. And because they colonize dead trees, we tend to think, well, they don't really matter. Well, it turns out that there are so many, these things really get moved around easily in wood packing material because dead wood, you know, it's perfect spot for these ambrosia beetles. And we know that if you got into some areas, this is just one study that was done in British Columbia, like maybe 80 to 90% of the ambrosia beetles that are out there are non-native. And so basically the problem is we don't really know. You know, these insects, like a lot of insects, are very important in terms of nutrient cycling and decomposition. We don't really know how a lot of these other species that we categorize as innocuous, they may actually be having some kind of profound ecological effects that we just don't know about. So that's something that I guess we'll find out later. And I think that is my last slide. So, ta-da.
So the pheromone traps I found to be really interesting. Does that actually then cause extinctions of the species or those pockets within 1 year? Or is it something where it's kind of over multiple years? Because I would imagine a few would breed, or do they lay eggs that last more than 1 year?
Yeah, I mean, the gypsy moths have one generation per year, but the traps are actually only used for finding isolated populations in new areas.
What was
then
the
mating disruption?
Sorry, the mating.
That's, well, actually we always thought that it actually had just one effect on 1 year, because it just, the idea is the material is gone after a year, and there's a window of about 3 weeks during which mating takes place, and then they spend most all the winter in the egg stage, and the next spring they hatch. Well, it turns out, we found out recently that actually a little bit of the material, these little pieces of plastic, they fall to the forest floor, that in the second year, they're actually still emitting a little bit of pheromone, and which is actually a little bit of a problem, because this release of of these pheromones at low concentrations, it prevents males from finding females, but it also inhibits the attraction of males to pheromone traps, and that's the main tool that's used to identify where populations are. And so it actually can cause a little bit of problems. So there's sort of pluses. This finding that we actually get effects in over 2 years, in some cases, with this mating disruption treatment, in some ways is good because it's suppressing the population over 2 years, but it's also can be somewhat bad because it's masking our ability to sort of see what the residual population there is. So.
Has there been some effort to go in and look at, you know, the percentage decline in populations due to these
Oh, yeah. I mean, and this is a technology that people have been trying to get to work since it was back in the mid-60s that people just first essentially realized that insects use chemicals for communication. And so they first identified the gypsy moth pheromone back in the mid-60s. When it was first identified, there was like an article in Science saying, oh, we're going to, like, this is going to completely revolutionize it. Pest management, because all we have to do is spray this stuff out of an airplane, and that will, you know, confuse insects' ability to find mates. Well, it turned out it wasn't that easy to do. Like a lot of things, ended up being much more complicated to get it to work. And so basically, it wasn't until one of the key things was finding the way to release small amounts of this material for a long time period. That sort of these little pieces of plastic turned out to be critically important. But so let's see, I can't remember where I was going with this, but it's something that there's been a lot of work, and we actually have very good data showing that it's very effective at very sparse, low population densities. When the populations get at all high, then males and females can find each other using visual techniques, and the mating disruption is not effective. And the other thing I should add is that mating disruption, it has probably virtually no undesirable side effects, in contrast to even using microbial pesticides that have undesirable effects on, say, native insects. This mating disruption has like no known negative impact, so it's a good thing. Yes?
How controversial were those 20 applications of BT? Speaking of...
In New Zealand, it was controversial, and not as, on the other hand, I could say you could never do that in the U.S. But in New Zealand, and I don't know how many of you have traveled to New Zealand, that the whole subject of alien species is such a higher level that the people are more, my opinion, people are more willing to tolerate things like getting sprayed 20 times with aerated pesticides. I mean, if you stop an ordinary person on the street, like Mike in New Zealand, and ask them, what do you think of the alien species problem? They're going to give you this whole description of, they've been burned, basically, right? And so they're going to all, in my opinion, most people have personal experiences with alien species, and they realize that it's something, it's an important subject. Now, that's not to say that New Zealand, even with the 20 applications, they had some negative feedback, but they've learned in these kind of things that you have to put a big investment on sort of public relations, and they've gone out of their way to make the public understand why they're doing this and, you know, what's the cost and benefit of it. You contrast that in, I don't know, we had a recent invasion in the San Francisco Bay Area of an insect called light-brown apple moth. It's a protrusive native Australia. It's one of these insects we've known for a long time. It's like a bad player. It's prolific, it eats all kinds of things. Big pests of grapes and apples. And the state of California knows that people are very adverse to any kind of spraying of anything. And so they took the most eco-friendly approach to eradicating this thing, which was using mating disruption, which is used in things like this barrier zone project with gypsy moth, but rarely done in eradication, because eradication, they usually want to really, you know, hit it hard. But they thought, well, we could do it. Anyway, to make a long story short, there was, even with this mating disruption, there was these public groups in California which thought that this mating disruption was awful and causing, you know, their dogs to go into heat and all these other, you know, incredible stories. And so they had the shutdown, a court injunction shut down the program, and they're still now, they're going to try to eradicate it using a sterile insect technique, which I think is probably not possible. But anyway, so it is, public relations is a big...